Well, people may have noticed by looking at the sort of title of this topic, Germany from 1918 to 1933 is a huge span of extremely important history to cover in a 35 to 40 minute talk. From the horror of the First Great War, the awe-inspiring yet unsuccessful German Revolution that put an end to the First World War, the establishment of the Weimar Republic, the deepest economic collapse the world has ever seen, and of course as well the horrifying yet resistible rise of the Nazi Party. I'm not going to attempt a full historical narrative of this period. Instead, I'm just going to try and draw out the most important lessons for socialists today. I think the rise of Hitler is perhaps the most written about and least understood event in modern history. Rightly so, I think it's a point of fascination for historians who seek to explain the emergence of fascism in Germany, the causes of the Second World War, and the ultimate depravity culminating in the Holocaust. Often, particularly in high school textbooks, explanations for the rise of fascism in Germany rest upon a pretty shallow character analysis of Hitler as like a particularly charismatic orator or a sensitive Austrian who was particularly pissed off by his rejection from art school and such. I think as well, alternatively, textbooks seek to blame the German population for the rise of Hitler. They call the Germans gullible or, you know, perhaps with like a particular taste for authoritarianism or something like this. I think a lot of these explanations don't even begin to scratch the surface in explaining how fascism could arise in the second most powerful industrial country in the world. Crucially as well, I think these explanations seek to isolate the rise of Nazism from its roots in the defeated German Revolution, which occurred only a few years earlier. The German Revolution is one that is often hidden from view, particularly when contrasted with the much talked about famous Russian Revolution only a year earlier. But it's an extremely important event, the German Revolution, for socialists to learn from, I think. At its heart, it held the potential to sweep away capitalism and all of its horrors, including the First World War, for good. But at every stage along the way of the revolution, it was those who called themselves socialists but were willing to compromise with the existing order who were the most effective gravediggers of the revolution. In doing so, they opened the doors to a vicious, counter-revolutionary, fascist movement that would eventually crush them, the Social Democrats, along with every piece of democratic freedoms that the revolution had won the German working class. The constitution and the supposed checks and balances as well of liberal democracy were no barrier, actually, to the militant fascist movement that arose. And instead, I think, these checks and balances and liberal democracy helped to foment the movement. Fascism in Germany, though, was not a preordained outcome. Had the German working class been united, I think, in a campaign against fascism, Hitler could have been stopped. All right, that's kind of my intro. There's a lot to cover. It's just the first slide. So I just want to give it a little bit of backdrop before we kind of get into the meat of it. Prior to the First World War, Germany was a rising industrial power, one that developed later than Britain and France. As its capitalist class grew under the Prussian monarchy, they became a bit frustrated by the lack of imperial power that they had at their disposal. Having colonies and outposts throughout Africa and Asia gave their rivals access to immense resources across the world, as well as allowing them, you know, control of various trade routes and other operations of the global market. So by the time Germany was a force that was capable of imperialist venture, the world had already been carved up pretty much between the empires. And I think this drive to compete of the German capitalist class is really what began World War I, although it was triggered by the assassination, of course, of Franz Ferdinand. So the First World War, it dragged on for a lot longer than anyone expected and created a whole bunch of social problems for every single country involved. The scale of the slaughter of World War I was in the millions. Food rations were severe and disease was widespread. The Russian Revolution of 1917, as well as the war ended, sent shockwaves around the world, and Russian soldiers began to agitate on the front lines and argue to German soldiers that workers of all countries have a common interest in ending the war and overthrowing all of their rulers. By 1918, after a temporary surge of confidence, it seemed that the German army were destined now to lose the war against Britain. This is just like a little map of what Europe looks like at the time. It's like a leftist cartoon from Germany, and you can see that Germany is depicted, the kind of bluish-grey ones at the top, as being like the aggressors pushing out in all directions. Cool. So it was in this context, with the war ending and Germany sort of seeming doomed to lose, that a crew of sailors in October of 1918 refused to be sent on what they knew was a suicide mission and instead revolted against orders. Their immediate arrest sparked the protest of thousands of sailors in Kiel who were joined by the city's port workers. Army patrols loyal to the government tried to attack the demonstrations, but they were forced to retreat from the town by sailors on the street who took up arms to defend themselves. The evening after the first demonstrations took place, a meeting of 20,000 men elected a sailors' council in Kiel. By the next morning, this council was the sole authority in the city, and the German Revolution had begun. News spread fast that this had happened in Kiel, and within 48 hours there were demonstrations and general strikes in other port towns, which, you know, respectively, elected workers and sailors' councils that held effective power everywhere. The revolution spread to Hamburg, the biggest city in the region, where 40,000 demonstrated and voted there for a Republic of Workers' Councils. Revolutionary soldiers took over the city's printing press, just a nice story, and produced a newspaper for the Hamburg workers, and they called it Red Flag. Its first edition proclaimed, "This is the beginning of the German Revolution. Long live socialism. Long live the German Workers' Republic. Long live world Bolshevism." In a matter of days, soldiers, sailors and workers' councils had swept the whole country, and the last city to fall was Berlin. Revolutionaries led workers to seize the Imperial Palace and take over the police headquarters. Revolutionary socialist Karl Liebknecht climbed to the door at the window, of the Imperial Palace, and he cried out, "The day of liberty has dawned. I proclaim the free socialist republic of all Germans. Those of you who want the world revolution, raise your hands." And thousands of hands were raised. So I think the point of talking about this is to say that the possibilities unleashed by the German Revolution were immense. It successfully ended the First World War and toppled the Kaiser. Had the revolution succeeded in establishing workers' control of society and overthrowing the capitalist order, it could have supported as well the besieged Russian Revolution and spread the revolution further onto other nations, whose populations were also on the brink of revolt at this time. All right. However, I think people, if you've been to a few sessions already today, I know I've learnt from a bunch of sessions, toppling the old order is not the same as beginning the new. I think I alluded to earlier in Germany, the role of the Social Democratic Party was to act on the behalf of the German capitalist class and the old order as agents of counter-revolution. So for years, the Social Democratic Party, which was called the SPD, had been revolutionary in words, but not in practice. They had argued that through gradual growth in influence through institutions of the state, that the advent of socialism was somewhat inevitable. Because they sought to take over the German state, they began to identify as well with its interests and ended up supporting the industrial slaughter of the First World War in 1914. Still, they maintained hegemony over the working class during the war, due, I think, in large part to a lack of organised left opposition to the SPD majority during the war. So in 1918, they were able to organise effective counter-revolution through, like, a lot of deception, really, of the soldiers and the workers. So they proclaimed their support for the Socialist Republic when they were out in the open, and behind closed doors, they organised for the old monarchy. There was revolutionary opposition to the SPD, but it was fragmented and very inexperienced and small. So its practice through the years of revolution, even as it swelled in size to rival the forces of the SPD, was characterised by a lack of political leadership, a lack of experienced organisers, and an inability to effectively intervene into struggle and push it in the right direction. I think nothing can be certain about history, but I think that the failure of revolutionaries to recognise the severity of the threat of the political tendencies that for years they had organised alongside of meant that they were underprepared when it became clear that their former comrades were actually the agents of counter-revolution. Cool. Just want to make a small note here about the Nazis. I'll come back to them, obviously, a lot later. It's here in the midst of the German Revolution when Adolf Hitler becomes a conscious anti-communist. Hitler was in Munich, which was a key centre of the revolution in 1918 and 1919. He was a committed German nationalist and was horrified by the display of workers' power that he saw. In later speeches, Hitler constantly denounces the November criminals and the social democratic leaders that he held responsible for the revolutionary upsurge and as well the fall of the Kaiser. The revolution left Hitler with a really visceral, pathological hatred of Marxism. He became involved in all of these nationalist, anti-Semitic groups which agitated against the revolution. And even after he had seized power, dismantled every single working class organisation, he feared another stab in the back, which is kind of the Nazi myth that is depicted in these two cartoons. The stab in the back being a workers' uprising, and it went on to influence a lot more of his policies. I'll come back to that later. So these are just some two kind of cartoons depicting the stab in the back. And you can see how the kind of anti-communist and anti-Semitic kind of tropes are welded together. So this guy is, the bearded guy is Philipp Scheidemann, who is the leader of the Socialist Party. And it's basically the same cartoon, but in that one, it's obviously a very exaggerated, disgusting, racist cartoon of a Jewish person stabbing the German army in the back. Cool. Next, I want to talk a little bit about the Weimar Republic. So by late 1923, the counter-revolution here had succeeded in defeating the immediate potential for socialist revolution in Germany. The following period, after the revolution had kind of died down, is frequently referred to as the Weimar era. So a window of relative stability between the early 20s and then the dawn of the Nazis. This is a period that is highly praised by textbook accounts of the period. It's a period of economic prosperity, liberal democracy and such. But as the French Jacobins had warned many years earlier, those who half make a revolution dig their own graves. I think the German Revolution had left the capitalist class in Germany intact, but pretty battered as well. And they thought they could only save themselves at this point by handing over a number of concessions to the revolution. The ruling class were so terrified, really, by the German Revolution, and they really did seek to crush it. But they were so afraid of the insurgent working class that they didn't want to provoke a head-on confrontation. So brute force alone, they just thought was too dangerous to use immediately. Instead, they relied upon the Social Democrats to restabilise capitalism and hold together their order. The SPD, being in name a Marxist party, was not the first choice of the capitalist class, but they had a really unique skill, and that was the power to contain and suppress the working class movement whilst also still posing as its champions. I think the Weimar political system was a really significant concession that was won by the German workers' movement. It existed a bunch like the kind of liberal democracy that exists today. Other concessions that were won by the movement were like the eight-hour day, a series of welfare provisions and such. The Social Democratic Party, like a Marxist party, was allowed to even rule for like 3 of the 14 years that the Weimar Republic existed. But I think whilst the outer veneer of the government was revamped, the parliament is not the whole of the state. So the core of the Kaiser's state, the imperial army, the police and the courts were all preserved and just transferred wholesale into the Weimar system. I think to believe that the Weimar period could have lasted forever is totally utopian. It was a temporary fix in a very difficult situation. In the long run, the German capitalist class sought to crush the memory of the revolution and all of the organs of workers' struggle for fear that in the next crisis, the workers' revolution could return. Whilst characterised as a period of like real stability, the Weimar era, there were some serious problems for German capitalism as well. Class tensions remained extremely high, constantly bubbling away beneath the surface. As well, one consequence of Germany's military defeat that's worth mentioning was the imposition of the Treaty of Versailles. This was the parasitic settlement that the war victors placed on their rival, which included the surrender of all German colonies to the victors, as well as a reparations bill that was set at £6.6 billion. It's kind of hard to like translate values across like time and countries to that extent, but we can be sure that in today's money, this is a sum greater than like 2.2 million British pounds. This was to remain a thorn in the side of German capital for a very long time to come. This is like just kind of a depiction, I guess, of the SPD and where they saw themselves politically. So on one side, holding back the rise of communism and the workers' movement, and then on the other, posing themselves as an alternative to the former monarchy. Cool. So in 1929, this like sort of somewhat stable society of the Weimar Republic came to a very abrupt end. So production dropped rapidly, 41.4% from 1929 to the end of 1931. There was massive poverty, suffering, and desperation for the masses. Virtually the entire youth population was unemployed in the crisis. Unemployment skyrocketed from 1.2 million to 6 million in 3 years, and millions more just scraped by in part-time and informal work as well. So just spending hours and hours in soup kitchen lines became a daily reality for millions of Germans. I think this economic crash happened in a lot of other places as well. People talk a lot about the Wall Street crash in 1929 too. But in combination with a half-made revolution, strong left-wing organisations and a really bitter far right meant that Germany was heading for a uniquely profound crisis and something different from the others. Thanks. So in this crisis, the SPD for a very long time had identified with the Weimar Republic, and this became like quite problematic for them as the crisis continued to deepen. The German population quite quickly lost hope in bourgeois democracy and the capitalist system's ability to improve their situation, and millions began to search for a political alternative. Because the population identified the SPD with the Republic and kind of the government system that had ruled for a little while, it proved impossible for the party to capitalise on the kind of radicalisation that was happening, let alone channel this radicalisation in a left-wing direction. The SPD participated in a governing coalition with bourgeois and conservative forces as well from 1928 to 1930, and these were exactly the people that, you know, more and more people were fed up with. From 1930 to 1932, they tolerated the authoritarian right-wing government by decree of Brunig as a kind of lesser evil opposed to the Nazis. And Brunig's solution was to the economic crisis was austerity and deflation. So he savaged the welfare state, which was why people liked the SPD in the first place. He raised indirect taxes and they pushed down wages. These measures spelt more untold suffering for the millions of workers who had supported the SPD. So they campaigned on the left, governed on the right, and they lost a whole bunch of credibility in the population. They were the architects of this sort of social, economic and political crisis that wracked the Weimar establishment, and they were the victims of it too. Okay, well, how did the communists fare is kind of an interesting question as well. What were they up to at this point, the revolutionaries we mentioned before? Well, the German Communist Party was also known as the KPD, had made many mistakes, as I before mentioned, was unable to lead a successful revolution in the early 20s and was underdeveloped, but it was in the early 20s as well still a mass party with a high degree of internal democracy and revolutionary enthusiasm as well. By the mid-1920s, though, the Communist Party organisation began to change quite fundamentally. As the Russian Revolution degenerated, it was battered by civil war and starved of any support from the outside of Russia, Stalin emerged and began to implement a really brutal capitalist dictatorship based on extreme repression of the working class. And this process not just affected Russia, but affected all of the satellite communist parties around the world. So Stalinization of the KPD in Germany began under the leadership of Thälmann and resulted in freedom of discussion and internal democracy being replaced piece by piece by a mood of like unquestioning discipline, authoritarian leadership. Nobody was allowed to challenge the party line. So oppositional currents were discouraged from speaking openly and were eventually forced out of the party. So at the point of crisis in 1929, Thälmann, so the leader of the communists, and Stalin agreed upon an ultra-left course against the Social Democrats, concluding that the Social Democrats represented a form of social fascism. This theory dictated that the Nazis and the Social Democrats were essentially two sides of the same coin. This meant that the communists drastically underestimated what the threat of Nazism really was to their existence, and they went as far as to proclaim that after Hitler, we will take over, which I think is a really kind of ominous sign of what was to come. They were very, very mistaken. Before the KPD became Stalinized, though, the question of how to relate to the Social Democrats and how to work with them, how to fight fascism, was a central and persistent debate within the party. You know, the Social Democrats were the party that was responsible for the murders of so many revolutionaries. So what approach should you have to, you know, other socialists and other workers who still follow the Social Democrats? Should they struggle head-on against the Social Democrats? I think theory of the United Front was really important in this time. People held the perspective that the party should initiate united fronts with the Social Democrats against the capitalists and also the burgeoning fascist movement in order to win. In 1920, this was played out in practice. The communists and the social democrats successfully united against the Kapp Putsch, which is a really famous event in history, in the common interest of defending the institutions of the working class. For the communists, I think this was an important strategy because it was vital to prove to the membership of the SPD, which is still the biggest working class party in Germany, that their leadership was not prepared to fight for them. They hoped that with the United Front strategy, the SPD and KPD members could be brought together in a common struggle, and the radicalising dynamic of mass movements would push the social democratic workers to the left. Sadly, this strategy did not last long and was replaced by the ultra-left force. I think whilst it's extremely important to recognise the failures of the left in this period and critique them and talk about their failures to take up the strategy of the United Front, it's also important to note that the communists fought the Nazis the hardest of anyone in this period. Hundreds of communists fought in like civil war-like street battles with the Nazis. And this became like a common scene in Germany from 1929 to 1933. After Hitler's ascension to power as well, no group resisted harder or paid as high a price in blood as the KPD. Nearly every third communist member went to prison under Nazi rule, and thousands were murdered as well. This is a bit of an image of how they did not initiate the United Front. So it looks like a really great kind of anti-fascist conference. But this kind of banner up the top here is actually all about making fun of the Social Democrats. And so nobody was really convinced by this conference that, like, actually we should work together in a non-sectarian fashion. Cool. Okay, well, now I want to talk a little bit about the Nazis. I think often when explaining the rise of the Nazis, historians focus on the things I was saying before, this kind of transhistorical, authoritarian Germanic identity, or the oratory skills of Adolf Hitler, or they go into like a deep biography of Hitler himself, you know, any sort of like minor detail in his life that could have led him to like start up a fascist movement in Germany. I think all of these perspectives really miss the political and economic basis for the very resistible rise of the Nazi Party to power and see the German masses in one way or another as either dupes or actually as like the core reason why it was that Hitler came to power. So I think the history of the Nazi Party really is inextricably bound up with active counter-revolution. So the November Revolution had showed the potential for a revolutionary democracy in which the mass of producers collectively control the wealth that they create. This terrified the ruling class, and they really sought to smash it. But they couldn't do it outright. They wanted to use kind of a carrot and stick approach. On the one hand, they were willing to make compromises, but also those compromises could not last. The Social Democrats, in their desire to smash the working class movement for the ruling class, formed the Freikorps. This was a counter-revolutionary volunteer army force of stormtroopers and loyal ex-soldiers. And I've got a picture of them up here. They're like rather terrifying looking. It was deployed across the country to murder opposition wherever it could be found. And this authoritarian force of counter-revolution that was formed by people who called themselves socialists actually quite organically became a base of the Nazi Party, and many of the sort of leading people in the Freikorps became the leadership of the Nazi Party as well. The ideology of Nazism as well is kind of difficult to unpick and a very complex phenomenon. A lot of the time it can seem such an incoherent kind of maze of hatred and lies. I think much of the policies that the Nazis put forward were designed to win converts to their movement rather than reflecting a lot of the real thinking of the leadership. But I think at the core of the Nazi Party you can identify that their ideology was kind of an extreme caricature of actually prevailing capitalist ideas in society. So, for example, people might know about Lebensraum. This is living space, and Hitler talks about it a lot. It was kind of just a more thoroughly racialized version of what had been actually German policy for a really long time, which was imperial expansion all across Europe. As well, of course, anti-Semitism was a really key feature of the Nazis' ideology. In Hitler's first political statement in 1919, he described the Jews as the racial tuberculosis of the nation, the solution for which must be the total removal of Jews from our midst. It's, like, disgusting. By the end of the Nazi rule, this racist conspiracy had become the Holocaust, of course, the systematic state-sponsored persecution and murder of 6 million Jews by the Nazi regime. think sometimes it can be hard to think about trying to explain such a revolting racist obsession. But I think even the most irrational ideas, especially ones that form the cement of an ideology that was so important in the 20th century, they have to have a cause as well beneath the surface. Anti-Jewish racism had existed, you know, throughout Europe for a long time at this point, but I think it didn't become a real crusade for the Nazis until 1919. Anti-Semitism becomes a real, like, passion for the Nazis. Thank you. When there was, like, a force of compulsion behind it. And that was what they saw as German defeat at the hands of workers' revolution. The Nazis' counter-revolutionary character, though, does not outweigh its anti-Semitism or, you know, there's no, like, one prevailing characteristic, I think. The two are so inextricably linked in the kind of fevered imaginations of this fascist army. Hitler described the Jewish as responsible for the proletarian revolution and the international Marxist movement. He said in Mein Kampf, only a knowledge of the Jews provides the key with which to comprehend the inner aims of communism. As well, the anti-Semitism of the Nazis was an attempt, I think, to capitalise on an anti-system sentiment that was felt by so many and turn it into a force of racist reaction. They styled themselves as National Socialists, proclaiming their support for the revolutionary overthrow of the current order as they sought to gain the support of the working class in Germany. Because the Nazis as well sought to build a base in the middle classes, they wanted to attack the ruling class, and they thought that that was really important, especially as small business owners' like hatred of parasitic big business grew in the economic collapse. The Nazis created an enemy of the bourgeoisie that was not based in class and exploitation, but instead on conspiracy. They deployed all of this propaganda against money-grubbing financial capital and depicted Jewish bankers as holding the German nation to ransom. So for the Nazis, the Jewish people served as both a scapegoat for both the hatred of the labour movement, but also at anger at the crisis-filled workings of the capitalist system. So how did they come to power, these hateful people? I think as the crisis in Germany deepened, the Nazis were able to build a mass base of support with their ultra-nationalist and economic populist rhetoric. They posed as a radical alternative, like I said before. So their membership rose dramatically through the crisis from 100,000 in 1928 to 850,000 by 1933. And the paramilitary wing, so the SA, grew from 60,000 to 400,000 members in the same period. I think it's important to note that Hitler never won an election before coming to power. So in the 1932 presidential election, many emphasised the importance of getting out the vote for Hitler's opponent, von Hindenburg. People pitched him as the only feasible alternative to the Nazis. Hindenburg actually won the election in 1932, but his government was unable to lift Germany out of the Depression, and they continued to implement vicious austerity. Hindenburg's government, you know, their support shrank very, very quickly in this instance. In 1933, Hindenburg and his advisers then decided to make a deal with Hitler. For Hindenburg, Hitler had the popularity that he lacked, and Hindenburg had the power that Hitler lacked. Hindenburg believed that the responsibility of being in power would make Hitler moderate his views, kind of fit in a bit more with the system. Hindenburg's advisers as well convinced themselves that they were wise enough and powerful enough to control and rein in this fascist movement. But, of course, they were totally mistaken. Hindenburg appointed Hitler to the Chancellery, and shortly after that, together they dissolved the Reichstag and began to rule by decree. At the end of the day, though, as well, I think it would have been like pretty much impossible for the Nazis to come to power without backing from the German ruling class. We were talking about the state before. I think the role of the state is to serve the long-term interests of the capitalist class by balancing varying interests in a way that overall preserves the status quo over time. So in circumstances of crisis and worker resistance, it's often less possible for the parliamentary model to kind of achieve a smooth running of society that's based on consent rather than brutal force. The heads of German industry and finance, I think, in the period of crisis, feared a real revival of all the social unrest and revolution that they were so afraid of, and they hoped that the Nazis, although that weren't their first choice, would be able to smash the labour movement for them. I think the capitalists were also pretty interested in starting up another war, even at this point, They wanted to avenge the dishonor of Versailles and yet again try to assert their power beyond the national boundaries of Germany. Here, actually, their interests converged with the Nazis quite naturally, who already enjoyed the support of the landowners, the military officers, and other sections as well of the German elite. I think something important to take out for today is that many still argue that the most effective or even the only barrier against the rising far right is voting for the lesser evil. Thank you. In Germany in 1933, this was proven totally disastrous. Parliament and democratic process was no barrier at all to fascism. Instead, I think it enabled Hitler's rise. If in the beginning the workers' parties instead, like we were talking about before, united to resist the Nazis, I think there's no doubt, actually, that their development would have been seriously hampered. Hitler himself confessed in retrospect, "Only one thing could have broken our movement. If the adversary had understood its principle and from the very first day had smashed with the most extreme brutality the nucleus of our new movement." Cool. Oh, I'm still going. Sorry.
You guys all just clapped for a Hitler quote.
Like, I wouldn't have finished on that, but yeah. Okay, cool. Cool. All right. Well, I am actually about to sum up, so you're not too far off. I think there are a lot of points that are important to draw out of this kind of whole period of history, though. The first being that revolutions happen. It's an important one that often gets missed. So the German Revolution successfully ended World War I, and it carried within it as well the potential for an utterly transformed society. In a world that is still dominated by horrors that are just unbelievable, the German Revolution and the Russian Revolution that inspired it were a beacon of hope at this time to oppress people across the world. Another thing to draw out is revolutions, when they happen, are the greatest nightmare of our rulers. They hold a very delicate position of minority rule, and given the opportunity, they seek to smash every memory of working class power possible. They do this through both violent ideas as well as extreme physical violence. It was this process of counter-revolution that drove the core of historical events from 1923 to 1933. I think the historic defeat, which ends with the horrors of the Nazis, is a warning. You cannot half make a revolution. Any compromise with the old order is temporary. Liberal democracy is not a protection from fascism. The law is not a protection from fascism, and elections are definitely not a protection from fascism. The only thing that could have defeated the Nazis is united working class opposition. So the refusal of the communists and socialists to fight together was what really allowed Hitler to come to power. I think the tragedy of a half-made revolution can be seen all throughout history. I think looking to Egypt right now, the people there now face an even worse, more punitive dictator than the one that they threw out in 2011. The readiness of the military to brutally repress revolution can be seen today as well in the military violence in the Sudanese revolution. I think although the Nazis were eventually defeated 12 years later, still today their legacy lives on, and the dynamics that cultivated them remain in place. Still today, the swastika is held up proudly by far-right groups across the world, and this is a new revival. They seek to channel hatred of the status quo that has been borne out by the economic crisis into extreme hatred and bigotry once more. It has always been organised socialists and communists who have organised resistance to fascism, and I think countering the influence of the far right with our power today is one of the greatest tasks of the international left. I think, finally, we can fight fascism when it rears its ugly head, but in order to ensure that we never again face the horrors of Nazism, we have to get rid of the root of the problem, which is the crisis-ridden system of capitalism. Only a successful socialist revolution can put to rest the threat of fascism for good. I think in order for a revolution to be successful as well, it cannot be left to fate. Our enemies are very organised and our ideas are very clarified. So we must be too. And now I'm actually done.